And we're talking with George Ure tonight about trends, lots of trends. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, George Ure, with us. George, how did you pick the 15 years when you call it the 15-year problem?
Well, it seems like it's very popular on the internet to make forecasts that are based on even numbers, 5-year increments. So if you go do a Google search, you'll find all kinds of predictions for 2010, 2015, 2020, 2025, and so forth. And I said, well, okay, but that doesn't really help me right now, because at my age in life, I'm most interested not in 20 years out, a little longer horizon than 5 or 10, so I just kind of settled on 15, and then I started doing a lot of visioning exercises, looking at the data and saying, okay, in housing, for example, what's going to change 15 years from now? What are my kids doing today? What are their consumption habits likely to be? What are other kids' habits likely to be? How are the millennials, who are new minimalists, they really don't buy stuff unless they desperately need it. And they don't have things in their homes like libraries, like, you know, I've probably got 1,000 books around here, and that eats up space. But all their stuff is, it's either on the web or it's on an iPad, and they just take it with them everywhere.
Well, they sure do.
And so that ripples over. In housing, a friend of mine is a mechanical and electrical engineer, does a lot of national work on large multifamily apartment complexes and condominiums and so forth. And we were talking last, two, three days ago. And the size of apartments is beginning to really come down. A two-bedroom apartment in a new 100-plus unit in New Jersey is typically in the 1,000 to 1,100 square foot range. And I know when I was looking at apartments, and this goes back, of course, to the dawn of time, but the two-bedroom apartments used to be in the range of 1,200-1,300 square feet. And it looks in the data like the average home size peaked in about 2006-2007 at 2,521 square feet. And if we look at the previous 15 years, back in 1973 or so, it was 1,660. I won't bore you with the numbers, but we could have house square footage drop back to 1,700 square feet or so in the next 15 years.
Are people just getting more practical again?
Yeah, they're getting more practical. You know, people are realizing that while a California King is a really nice bed, some of these new two-bedroom apartments that are coming out have master bedrooms that are 11 feet by 12 feet, and a California King just ain't happening in there if you want to have some furniture. And so what ends up happening is people are reconsidering things like, well, okay, can a couple get along in a queen-size bed? So it's all this downsizing, and that will ripple into all parts of the economy. It'll ripple in manufacturing. It'll ripple in raw materials. It'll ripple in trucking, in delivery, in house design, all the rest of it. And so housing is just one example, but we have a lot of other areas in life. Food consumption, being fat just is out. And so people are becoming more total calorie conscious. And obesity, while we still have a lot of it,
it's still an epidemic, George.
Oh, sure. But people are slowly becoming aware of it, and they're beginning to roll back a little bit now, but those trends are likely to accelerate. We'll probably be, I won't say leaner and meaner, but certainly leaner 15 years from now, because there's so much research that shows that obesity is linked to premature death.
What's the motive for all this? Are they trying to screw up our lives? What are they trying to do?
I'm not so sure it's necessarily a they so much as it's we may not understand complexity as well as we think, because whenever we went large, like with the McMansion homes, we found out that on the other side of the McMansion mentality was a housing collapse. On the other side of, you know, the 6,000-pound automobile with fins on it was the smart car, the Fiat, the Leaf, you know, that whole genre of new cars. The people today are looking at those of us who are turning gray. You're not in that category, but I certainly am.
Oh, yes, I am.
And as we're starting to gray, they're looking at us going, okay, why do I want to be hostage to a job when I can have a little bit of savings, a much smaller compact lifestyle, be way more portable, and change dramatically impact on the planet? And that's really happening. I mean, young people today are much more likely to live in the downtown urban core. When I bought my first brand new house in 1973, it was, 35 minutes commute and a toll bridge away from downtown Seattle. When my kids start looking at places to live, they're not even looking at areas outside the downtown core because they want to be close. Well, they are if it's close to work, but in general, they want to be near their friends, and their friends can't afford these, you know, the home prices from 2009's collapse still really haven't come through. A lot of that is still owned by venture capital firms that are trying to rent, still owned on bank inventory that the Fed, wink, wink, let's not put them all on the market at once because it'll get really ugly. So as a result, young people and the different changes in coupling and so forth, that's all changing how housing demand is working out. It's easier to move IKEA furniture than it is to move some, you know, antique solid wood, doesn't come apart, need a 36-inch door to get it through.
Hire movers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you can move that stuff very simply. And IKEA furniture works. It is storage. It isn't, you know, it may not be the old world craftsmanship of, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But on the other hand, like I said, these are practical kids, and they've seen how the parents go through the stress, the high blood pressure, the destructive behaviors, and even, I think, to an extent, the destructive marriage process. Many of today's kids are products of divorced homes, and as a result, they're marrying much later. They're taking it far more seriously, and they don't want to have do-overs because they've either lived through it or have friends who have lived through it. There's a tremendous emotional cost, and so they're very, very cautious relationship-wise, and that's why they spend so much time on social, because they want to be sure, they want to have confidence in who their friends are.
Well, and how do you see the future of social networking?
I think it continues. At some point, I think it will begin to diminish for a couple of reasons, one being people's interest will change over time. The big bubble in terms of new users of social has probably maxed out or close to it, because like Citizens Band Radio, you know, it's a fad. And it's ridiculous when you go out to dinner to see two people sitting across from each other texting. And
happens all the time, George.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And so when I go out to dinner, you know, my wife and I don't carry cell phones. If somebody wants to get a hold of us, they'll leave a message, and we'll check the messages once a day. But I think today's young people are in that process of learning to navigate around this excess information era. You can spend literally 24 hours a day on Facebook, and there's no money in it. There's money in it for Facebook because they sell ads, and for people who are promoting, they're now selling posts, distribution of posts for large groups. But the genuine core user, the single millennial kind of person, or even the married, you know, why do you need to have all those posts up there? There's also a realization that HR departments are looking at your Facebook page when you go looking for a job. They're looking at all your social. When somebody looks at me and says, gee, is this your guy worth looking at in terms of any kind of a consulting problem we might have that he could potentially deal with, I can guarantee you that they look at my LinkedIn and
sure.
Do you blame them? No, not at all. I mean, it's really smart, but it's also how the NSA is doing social mapping. So if you know this person and they're a radical, then social media lets you be tracked in unique and novel ways. The TV show, Person of Interest. Have you seen that?
I have not. I don't watch much TV other than news.
George. Well, the real short version of Person of Interest.
Working too much.
Well, you got to stop. Well, no, you can't.
I can't.
It's team treadmill, you see. And that, again, the millennials get that. They're going, treadmill. No. We want our time. And that's why these, you know, instant services like social, like Amazon Fresh and all that. But Person of Interest is a show about a government, a theoretical government computer that goes looking for terrorism and blows off other kinds of crime. And the inventor of it doesn't like that, so he goes off to fight crime on his own. The thing about social is that's not entirely far-fetched.
No, it's not.
And then you couple all of that with facial recognition, you know, license plate recognition, and the increasing militarization of police departments. I mean, who would think that out here in rural Texas, our sheriff's department needs to have a mine-resistant anti-personnel carrier?
But you know, what happens when this technology fails? Technically.
Oh, then it gets really interesting. Interesting is another word for ugly bloodshed, terror in the street, because we still have the soft underbelly issues that we haven't addressed yet. We haven't addressed organic farming. We've still got soil depletion, so we're totally dependent on energy supplies for maintaining food production. We're totally dependent on the electric grid for food production, distribution, communications, and banking. So that's a soft underbelly. The National Commission on EMP report from 2008 said, yes, one electromagnetic pulse device could effectively wreck America for 6 to 18 months. And in the event transformers were attacked or substations, we don't really have transformer replacement manufacturing capability in America. I mean, that stuff's got to come on a boat from Asia. And how are you going to call Asia if the phone lines are down? I mean, it gets to be that kind of a problem. And that's all also part of the what I call this 15-year problem. We're in a period where the economy is at its most vulnerable. In the case of the 1930s episode, where we had a similar convergence of multiple disruptive technologies, what we saw was government was way behind the curve trying to address things after that it was simply too late. The new technologies came out in the late 1800s. Airplanes were starting to fly pretty reliably by World War I, and yet it was how long before airplanes were regulated. Same thing with radio. Well, we've got the network computer, which means that business is being conducted on the internet. Labor is being conducted on the internet. There is no internet OSHA to see if you're using the right keyboard or whatever. And yet, if you do that, if you do any kind of work in a physical setting, you've got all kinds of, you know, air conditioning, heating, cooling, air quality, parking places, pollution, first aid kit requirements. You know, the list goes on and on. So government is going to be reactive in this, and that's why I wanted to chat with you really about this 15-year gulf. You know, we've built this really cool technology. It's in the middle of digging a big ditch, and how do we all get across it safely without the bridge collapsing and without us losing our freedoms in the process?
Is it going to collapse?
I wrote about that in the ebook I wrote, Broken Web. I think it could collapse, but there are like four clusters in the data of how the collapse could occur. One would be electronic attack. Let's say the Cold War between Russia and the U.S. returns and China gets involved, and you know it becomes the worldwide hacking web. Another cluster would be EMP, and that leads to World War III because it's kind of
true.
Yeah, I mean, a cornerstone of military doctrine is if somebody launches an EMP attack on America, it's an attempt to blind us, and that would just automatically bring a massive first strike response. But that's a cluster in data.
And you haven't ruled any of that out, have you?
No. I mean, there's no way to. All I can do is you know, throw darts at the chart and go, well, there's a cluster of darts here, there's a cluster of darts here. Another one is that governments are, and this was very clearly something I spelled out in Broken Web, is the more of these spontaneous mob government uprisings that occur. In other words, the more electronic technology is used to perpetrate government change overnight, the more incentive there is for governments to get hard and start regulating the kind of content that can go on the internet. And once that happens, then you kind of get into the China model. And after that, then it's a matter of, you know, who goes how far in suppressing the right to free expression on the internet.
You know, sometimes, George, we see these movies, Big Brother up on the screen, talking to the people, and, you know, they're mesmerized by him. Is that conceivable? Are we going to see that?
What most people don't realize is it's here. You don't think of it as Big Brother, though. It's in advertising, there's reach and there's frequency. And reach is how many people receive a message. Frequency is how many times they receive that same message. And at some point, it becomes a psychologist would call it imprinting, and I call it programming the people computer. And it's simply a matter of repeating something enough times that people believe it. And the difficulty we all have in today's world is maintaining the mental acuity that it takes to sort out the wheat from the chaff. Fine example in Peoplenomics this morning, I was explaining to subscribers there. I said, look at this case of the Crimean naval base. One of the national news sites called it Russian Forces Seize Ukraine Base. Well, it was actually pro-Russian forces, and it was actually the Crimean naval base, admitted another report, and pretty soon it wasn't even pro-Russian forces, it was the Crimean self-defense forces. And they didn't seize it, they simply walked in and ran up their flag, and they were unarmed in the process. But for that one event, depending on your predisposition and how you've been programmed to source your news, you're either going to go to one website, which is going to be promoting the aggressive Western stance, or you're going to go to the pro-Russian side, which will promote the pro-Crimean independence view. And somewhere in that continuum lies the truth. And we're not teaching people how to do that. And because we're not, that's the real danger in this 15-year period while people begin to reassert control and choose their sources.
We're going to come back, George, and chat more with you on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, next hour, let's take your phone calls with George Ures. We talk about trends, maybe get some of your own predictions. We'll do all that, and I've still got to talk with him about some other things when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, George. You're with us. George, I'm tracking this Malaysia plane situation as well, too. Now they're beginning to report that radar is showing some kind of large object down there at the bottom of the sea. So who knows what's going on there?
Yeah, that's a sad case. We'll just have to see what they find.
Yep. sure do. Now, you and I differ, I think, on peak oil. I happen to think that this planet has an abundance of oil, that it was formed with the hydrocarbons when this planet was formed. Doesn't mean we should be using it, but I think we've got a lot. I think you believe in peak oil, right?
Yeah, I do. I understand the abiotic oil concept, and the problem with abiotic oil is that it's a geological time scale, and we're consuming energy at internet time scale. And so while there may be some chemical rationale to the abiotic side, the reality is that the current situation in oil and energy involves fracking, which is replacing a drop in the traditional liquid petroleum that's coming out of the ground. And you could begin to see that in the Energy Information Administration data as early as 2012. We also, I think you even had him on at one point, if I'm not mistaken, Matt Simmons.
Oh yeah,
great guy, and really, I think his book Twilight in the Desert is one of the best, still one of the best out there in terms of understanding the water cut issues that are facing large-scale deposits. And there are other issues as well, that obviously the environmental issues that we learned from the Gulf of Mexico disaster and the increased difficulty in getting the resource out of places like Mexico. So I think we both agree on the need for conservation and wisdom. I'm just looking at what looks to me in the data like a big rounding curve. And fracking is providing a short-term boost in total quadrillions of BTUs, but over the next 10 to 15 years, like it or not, we may come down significantly on the peak oil dark side. And what further complicates it is economics are starting to run against us, as well as demographics. And basically, the reason we have a lot of energy right now is really threefold. We've got a decrease in demand because we're in an economic contraction. Number two, the cost of putting in new rigs and reworking old fields is very low because financing rates are so cheap. And then the third reason is millennials really are environmentally conscious, and they watch the Gulf of Mexico thing unravel on television. They've seen the after effects of Exxon Valdez and so forth, and so their consumption habits are changing. But that doesn't stop the reality that plastic and food are still major outputs from oil. And to feed 7 billion people, my assessment is that we're going to be sliding down that slope on the bad side of peak oil sometime between we're already in it or 5-10 years out. And no matter how that slope works out, it's not going to be a fun ride.
No. Well, we shall see.
Yeah.
We shall see. What about wars, George?
Wars are really interesting. I say interesting because I'm a huge fan of Nicholas Kondratiev's economic theories that basically he went back through European records to the 1100s and found a regular 48 to 60 year kind of a cycle in the economy. And it almost is like the one generation makes it. Another generation is kind of a steward, and then a third generation wastes it, and then the cycle begins again. It's almost like that. Every 50 years or so, America has been involved in a very serious war, and we can start with the British-American War, the second war with England, which was the War of 1812. And then fast forward from that 50 years, and we're in the American Civil War. And then 50 years after that, we're in World War I. And 50 years after that, we're in the Vietnam War. And 50 years after that, And here we are today.
Well, and don't forget World War II.
And World War II. Yeah, the difference between them is in long wave economics, you have what are called peak wars and trough wars. Trough wars are the wars that tend to come when the economy has bottomed out, and you need to have a need for war. But historically, what wars do is they kill people and break things and create a tremendous increase in demand. And so World War II killed a lot of people, but it also broke a lot of infrastructure, so much so that my late father had a marvelous saying. He said, if you want to become a prosperous country, go to war with the United States and wait 30 years. And that certainly was the case with Germany, which prospered dramatically in post-World War II Europe. It was the case with Japan. Both became mighty manufacturing powers. And similarly, if you go back into the gay 90s period of the 1800s, you saw another kind of period there where we were looking for things to do following the panic of 1873. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of each one of these long wave declines, like we're in right now, there's a tendency to either have war or some other production killer so that you can keep people busy. I know that sounds almost conspiratorial, but the data argues that people have to have something to do. Otherwise, we would just have a leisure class.
Well, not only that, you know, I'm convinced sporting events kind of dampers people from going crazy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sporting events are just a furtherance of the bread and circuses policies of the latter-day Roman Empire. And so, yeah, but we don't have... soccer is probably as close to a global sporting event as we have right now. But whether that can create enough demand, I mean, you know, how many people can you employ building logo T-shirts and stuff? That's not the same as rebuilding Dresden in the wake of firebombing.
Right.
You know, in terms of stimulating the economy.
I think the biggest concern in this 15-year period will be the difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Yes, but that's where we get back to that whole communications thing. The other item that's going to play into that, George, and it really is going to define the haves and the have-nots, is this massive change that is happening already in education. MIT has got its open courseware project, which essentially lets anybody with a computer get at very good curriculum on all kinds
online.
Online. And there are new schools and new approaches to online education that are coming out. There's an outfit called, I think it's Mentoring Animation, that is doing online computer game graphics and high-end visual design online, because number one, you can't do that kind of stuff in a classroom unless you've got a huge computer bank, and then it takes so many people in a tight, concentrated area. But they have a system of doing online mentoring and peer review as well. That's pretty interesting. I was talking to a colleague about it yesterday. And then the other thing that's going on is down at the just learn how to do something level, you've got the free stuff on Instructables and YouTube. And then the next tier up is going to be the low end of courses, the courses that'll be either avocational or entry-level kinds of training. And those are being developed on a platform called Moodle, M-O-O-D-L-E, .org, which is kind of like WordPress did for blogging, except it's doing it for education, and so anybody can put together a course on anything. I happened to run into it for the first time when I was looking at training for a training situation for offshore oil workers, how to get their OSHA certification, how to get their first aid this, how to get, you know, these different certs you have to get certified on to go offshore. And you can go through those courses online for like $50 a piece, and the whole course is something, you know, the whole slate of courses to go out and become a junior oil rig worker is on the order of like $500.
That's it?
Well, yeah. Well, there's a little more to it. You have to pay out of your own pocket and go to a helicopter upset course where they teach you how to get out of a helicopter that's upside down underwater in the dark, and that runs about $1,500. But yeah, for $2,000, somebody who's got, you know, some mechanical aptitude, maybe some basic welding skills and so forth, you know, they can get into that offshore and even onshore development of oil resource. But, you know, that's happening in education, and that's going to put a tremendous pressure on the brick-and-mortar schools, which are, they're still good. I mean, don't get me wrong. Given a choice between going to a no-name school like I did, or, you know, going to a Stanford or Wharton, well, gee, yeah, but I couldn't do that while working and supporting a family. So that's the kind of change that's coming. It's going to be the segmentation, if you will. Used to be that college was one thing. You know, you go, you sit, everybody sits in that class where there's 300 people in English 101, and everybody takes bonehead math and, you know, that kind of stuff. But those are going online, and anymore employers are getting away from looking at the contacts that you may have in social circles, you know, like the fraternity, sorority, unless you're in a contact critical field like high-end finance. And they're really looking at what can you do. And that's going to change dramatically in the next 15 years, because it's one thing to invest 5 or 10 or even 15,000 in an online education versus spending 60, 70,000 in a resident program and more if you have to, you know, buy a dormitory or a place to live and food for 5 or 6 years while you're offline. And one of the best deals out there, and I understand there's even a waiting list for it right now, is going into something like the U.S. Coast Guard. It's all the good things about the military, and yes, there are some overseas assignments in harbor security and so forth, but you know, you can get the pluses of being in the military, things like veterans preference and so forth, as well as veteran education.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it really is. In fact, one of my friends, his son graduated top of his class, Air Force Academy, went to MIT. He's now in, you know, super fighter pilot school. And when he gets done with his military commitment, he will probably have a job for life, either as a test pilot or as an airline pilot. But even those jobs, George, 15 years from now, you got to look at what's going on with Alaska Airlines. It's really been out on the leading edge of Category 3 landings, which basically is almost a land-itself airplane. And that kind of robotic stuff is also likely coming. So when you look at the future, and this is really the message for my kids and anybody who's under 50, is, you know, look at your job situation today and ask yourself, how could I be replaced by a machine or by software or a combination? And there are some real bright spots. Individual heating and ventilation contractors, you can't automate that one. You got to have somebody go out and work on a system. You can monitor remotely, but when it comes to swapping out a compressor or, you know, checking you know, freon pressures on site and meeting all the EPA requirements for recycling of gases, well, that's obviously not going to be replaced by robotics tomorrow. On the other hand, inbound or outbound telemarketing, that stuff could be in trouble much sooner. Mm-hmm. Because, well, I think I've told you this in the past, or maybe I didn't. I was the first guy ever to say, please hold, I have an important call for this number. And that was back in 1985 at a company called Micro Peripheral, which became the foundation, which grew into Avaya, which really owns the inbound and outbound telephone marketing. And those systems, by the way, can call across hundreds of phone lines and deliver messages from politicians. I mean, I remember the first outbound mission we did back in the micro-peripheral days was we literally called every voter of a particular party in the state of Nevada in a 128-hour period.
And I bet you won.
I don't remember the outcome. I was more interested in how our proprietary Unix front end called UNOS was working. But that's the kind of automation problems we're going to start really see stack up on us here. And so you need to be in areas like healthcare. You know, I'm not inclined to roll my sleeve up to a robot yet.
How much of this gets backed up, George, if there's a major war or conflict?
Depends how much of our infrastructure remains and how hard the infrastructure is. Obviously, if we were to have a major war that disrupted electricity, oil refinery, movement of fertilizer and oil and gas up and down the Mississippi core, then we could all be back in Victory Gardens and farming would become a tremendously honorable thing. We've got, one of my wife's kids actually has trained mules up in Arkansas. Those things still work, and they're wonderful animals. They're big, they're smart,
and they don't complain.
And they don't complain, and they don't take diesel. And you keep them healthy and feed them well, and they'll till up the field all day long. It's hard on the human. And it's not like an air-conditioned cab in a deer, but it gets the job done. And so, that's the problem with war, is it does keep a population busy. It doesn't keep them happy, but it keeps them busy. And if you're fighting an enemy called, like, hunger or thirst, then you're not going to be fighting the government that may be passing out the medicines that are in short supply, or the critical food, or God forbid we go to biological warfare, another one of those 15-year problems.
Possibility.
You know, and maybe those are the guys, you know, down at Walmart who are passing out, you know, come in and get your ration of groceries, and here's your medications for whatever the disease du jour is. So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of bumpiness we've got out here, and it's really, on the one hand, encouraging when the Federal Reserve comes up with a central tendency scatter chart, as they did following, you know, today's meeting. They released all the supplemental things.
But and the market panicked.
And the market didn't like it. Yeah, I mean, the market doesn't want to hear that rates are going to go up, because what it means is stock prices are going to come down. If rates go up to 5%, we're going to have a Dow that's at or below where it was in 2009 just because of competitiveness.
George, we're going to take this break, come back with much more next hour on Coast to Coast AM.